Back in the late 1980s, I was listening to the radio. I don't know how I happened to come across it, but there was this guy on the radio named Paul Harvey who was telling this great story. It was kind of mysterious, and he got to the end, and he said, "And now you know the rest of the story." I thought, that was great. I love this guy. And I went and I started talking. You know, I heard this guy named Paul Harvey. It's like, yeah, we know. Everybody knew except for me. There was this guy named Paul Harvey. And I loved him, and I used to try to arrange my day, so I'd pick up his, I think it came on like 11 o'clock, and I'd try to pick up Paul Harvey and hear what he's going to say, and especially the rest of the story, and it was great fun. For those of us who are watching the Super Bowl in the year 2013, there came a Chrysler Ram truck commercial on, and there was like a holy stillness that settled over the entire nation in a lot of places because Paul Harvey had died in 2009. But he had this famous sketch that he did. It was called "On the Eighth Day, God Made a Farmer." And against the backdrop of Chrysler trucks, you know, being used by workers, was this dialogue, this transcript, actually a recording of Paul Harvey. He says, "And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, 'I need a caretaker.' So God made a farmer. 'I need somebody with arms strong enough to rustle a calf and yet gentle enough to deliver his own grandchild. So God made a farmer. I need somebody willing to sit up all night with a newborn colt and watch it die, then dry his eyes and say, maybe next year. I need somebody who will finish his 40-hour week by Tuesday noon and then put in another 72 hours. Somebody who would bail a family together with a strong, soft bond of sharing. So God made a farmer." For all of us who love Paul Harvey to have that come on during the Super Bowl, it's like, yeah, boy, I missed that. That was so great. At his peak, he was listened by 22 million people on 1,300 radio stations and every day except for Sunday. And he was like the original conservative radio host. Before there was Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, there was Paul Harvey. And the thing that made him most famous was his little tag at the end, the rest of the story. And I loved those from the moment I heard them. Eventually, they were published in two books, and I immediately got both books. And the rest of the story, you realize how important that is to Christianity. Without that idea, you know, the rest of the story, now you know the rest of the story, nothing we do would make sense, because so much of what we do now, we are patiently waiting for the conclusion to the rest of the story. And in so much of what we do now, it wouldn't even make sense if we didn't know that there would be a good rest of the story. So it's like everything to the Christian faith. And when we heard our scripture reading today from Mark chapter 9, this is where Jesus is talking about the time when he is going to be crucified, and then he says that he will also be resurrected. So let me just remind you of some of the highlights here as we look at the entire message, and I want you to see the emotions that are going on in John's heart, because this is a series on the Apostle John, the life and teachings of John, and not only his heart, but all the disciples together kind of acting in unison here. So it says, "They departed from there on the subject of the transfiguration. They departed from there, and they passed through Galilee, and he wished not that any man should know it, for he taught his disciples." And then we have this added from the other Gospels. "But while they wondered, everyone, at all the things which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, 'Let these sayings sink deeply into your ears.' And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is delivered,'" in Matthew, "shall be betrayed, 'is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And after he is killed, he shall rise," Matthew says, "be raised again the third day. But they understood not that saying. And, as Luke says, it was hid from them that they perceived it not. And they were afraid to ask him." And Matthew adds, "And they were exceeding sorry." I'm so interested in these emotions that are described by all the gospel writers. So in Mark 9, it just simply says they were confused. They understood not that saying. They didn't understand it. And the way Luke says it, it was hid from them and they didn't perceive it. So they were confused. And then back to Mark, it says they were afraid to ask him. So they were confused. They were afraid. And then we get this from Matthew. This is so interesting. They were exceeding sorry. And the Greek construction there, they were exceeding sorry. That means very much exceeding, and then added to that deep sorrow. So they were very exceedingly deep, a lot sorry. They're trying to communicate to us here, the gospel writers, that John and his fellow disciples were confused and they were afraid and they were very sad. Very sad. And that's just about it, right? That is what the gospel came for. That's what we need today at a time like this. We need somebody to help us in our confusion and our anxiety and our sadness. And that's what Jesus is doing. And that's why the rest of the story is so important. I call this message Confused, Afraid, and Sad No More, because the disciples, of course, are going to be cured of all of this confusion, their anxiety and their depression. We want to look at two things. Confusion, in the first place, always stands behind the believer's anxiety and depression. If you were never confused, you would never be fearful or sad. If you as a believer are ever fearful or sad, you can be sure that you have those emotions because you're confused. And the second thing we want to look at is that confusion is cured by the word of Christ and by time as we walk with Christ. So let's look at some of this. Confusion, again, this is a lack of perspective or insight. What we need is perspective or insight when we're going through a crisis. And if we don't have the perspective and insight, we will be afraid and we will be sad. So if you're experiencing any fear or sadness at this very moment, let me assure you, you are having that problem because of another problem. That's confusion. If you are a believer. Now, a disclaimer. Confusion is not entirely to blame for the unbeliever's anxiety and his depression. So if you're not a believer, then confusion isn't your problem. For unbelievers, it is logical for you to be afraid and sad, because your eternal destiny isn't good. So if you have the wherewithal to have a sense of dread over your eternal destiny, that's good. You should be afraid and you should be sad if you're not a believer. So when I talk about confusion standing behind all the believers' sadness and fear, that would not be true of an unbeliever. Secondly, in contrast to the confusion that Christians have that causes them unnecessary fear and sadness and pain, sometimes unbelievers have happiness because of their confusion. In other words, their train is rumbling toward the precipice with the bridge out, and they don't know it. Because they are so confused, they're happy. And it's too bad, because it would be better if they were aware and awake, but they're not. So anyway, what I'm saying today is for believers, and it really isn't going to make sense for unbelievers, and you just have to know that on the front end. All right, so confusion arises because of unfulfilled hopes, expectations, and these, in many cases, you know, for the believer, they seem to make sense. Like, I am surprised, like in the first bullet point there, I'm surprised that the good circumstances that other people enjoy never seem to come my way. I mean, why can't I catch a break like that guy did in jobs, in finances, in health, in relationships? Why did that guy get to marry a girl like that and I didn't? Why did that guy get the promotion and I didn't? Seems like this guy catches all the breaks, I catch none of them. And I thought that good things were going to come my way when I was, you know, 18 years old. I thought that the world was going to give me good things, and I've learned that the world doesn't give me nothing. So what's going on? I'm confused. And if you're confused, then you're also going to be anxious and depressed. The other thing that happens is that we have good circumstances. No, I did have a great romance. I had a great job. I had lots of money. I had things looking up, bright prospects. And then it went away. And I'm confused. Like, what did I do to make it go away? What's happening that now God seems to think I don't need this anymore? Did I do something wrong to God? Did I do something wrong in wisdom? Why did the good things that I did have go away? And we're confused. And then once you get confused, the next thing is anxiety and depression. You can take that to the bank. Luke says they were confused because it was hid from them. And we don't really know what Luke had in mind specifically when he said this, but perhaps all blindness comes from an interplay between our own predispositions against certain things, like I don't see that because I don't want to see that, along with satanic deception. The devil has blinded the minds, and perhaps even divine blindness. The Lord says, you know, I'm going to send you deception. I'm going to send you a deceiver because you don't love the truth. And maybe most blindness, most confusion is a result of how all three of these play together. My own reluctance to hear the truth. He that has ears to hear, let him hear. My reluctance to believe the truth when I do hear it. What Satan is doing in my heart with temptations and perhaps even God's judgment. Well, if you don't want the truth, I'm not going to send you any more truth tellers. I'm going to let you be inundated with deceivers. So maybe all of that. At any rate, John and his fellow disciples were confused. Once they got confused, it was natural for them to have also anxiety. It says they were afraid to ask him, and depression. They were exceedingly sorrowful. If believers in the midst of their crises could just see, like if I could just have perspective, and if I could show you the right perspective, if I could have insight about what's happening in your life right now, that would change everything. If you could see the radiant, glorious ending to your life story, you know, the rest of the story, then you wouldn't feel so badly about the crisis that you're in right now. But because we don't have the perspective and insight that we need, the trauma seems unnecessarily harsh and scary and depressing. We never see as we could see, as we should see. In 1921, these missionaries named the Floods, David and Svea, decided to go to Congo, Africa, from Sweden. They left, you know, bright-eyed young Christian people ready to do their bit for God and his kingdom. What a nice couple. Well, they got to that place in Africa where they wanted to be, and the leader of the tribe wouldn't even let them go into the tribe that they had counted on. So they told everybody, we're going to go to such and such a tribe. They get there, and the leader of the tribe says, oh, no, you're not. You can't go. Well, that causes hardship in poor young missionary kids' lives. And so there they were with confusion, anxiety, and sadness. We can't even go to the tribe we told everybody we're supposed to be entering. Well, they had one convert, just one. It was a boy who would deliver their groceries to them from time to time. So after all of that sacrifice, have one convert. That's confusion, anxiety, sadness. I mean, we gave up an awful lot to be here for one young grocery boy to accept us. Did we do the right thing? Short time after the Floods arrived in Africa, Mrs. Flood came up pregnant, and she had her first baby, a little girl, and they named her Ina. But Mrs. Flood died because of complications in childbirth. Wow, they haven't even been here very long. They can't get to the tribe they want to go to. They have one convert to their name, and now Mrs. Flood dies in childbirth. That causes confusion, causes anxiety, it causes depression, sadness. It's terrible, and it just keeps coming. Well, in bitterness and utter despair, Mr. Flood, David, decided that he would give his baby up for adoption to some fellow missionaries because they were such good people, and he didn't know if he could do a good job raising Ina. So he came home in utter despair, leaving his baby in the hands of his missionary friends. Within 8 months after David left Africa, the missionaries who were taking care of Ina, they also died. Oh, no. So confusion, anxiety, and sadness. A fourth time. This is just awful. So David Flood finally came to believe that the entire enterprise was a fool's errand. God had deeply disappointed them, let them down on every possible level, and he regretted that he ever took his lovely wife to Africa to do this in the first place. Well, in the meantime, Ina, the orphaned girl now, is being raised by parents who have adopted her in the United States. As a young woman, a magazine comes to her mailbox, a missions magazine from Sweden. It comes to her mailbox, and she's reading about her parents, you know, her biological parents. And it says that her mother, Ina, shortly before she died in childbirth, led a young boy who used to bring groceries to their house to the Lord. Well, that young boy, now a Christian, grew up to become a school teacher, and he would use his influence as a school teacher to lead all of his students to Jesus in the very tribe where Mr. and Mrs. Flood had hoped to reach people. And so all of these students have become Christians. And beyond that, the same grocery boy uses influence to start a church in which 600 people now worshiped. So Ina is reading this as a young woman, and she says, I got to find my biological dad and show him this. So she finds her elderly father, and the elderly father is still mad at God for this entire fiasco of sending him to a place where nothing worked out at all, and God was just mean to him. And in the end, when he heard the rest of the story, it's interesting, the article that printed this used the term the rest of the story. When he learned the rest of the story, he realized that God was not mistreating his family so many years ago. They had done exactly what they intended to do when they were bright-eyed young missionaries. You see, when you don't see the rest of the story, then there's this confusion. I don't see it. I don't see the rest of the story. Right. There's this confusion. And then you mark it down. Once the confusion sets in, then you're going to have anxiety. You're afraid of certain things. You're going to have depression. And they always go together. And that's what Jesus did with his disciples. He said, you realize I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to raise from death after 3 days. And it says that they were confused. They didn't understand what he was saying. And they were afraid to ask him. Fear. And also they were exceedingly sorrowful when they heard it. That's the way it always is. So the rest of the story. Now you know the rest of the story for Mr. and Mrs. Flood. Adoniram Judson is just like this. And I share this with you from time to time. It would be difficult for me to imagine a person who had a harder life than Adoniram Judson. It just was as hard as it gets. Remember that he was a missionary who had his loved ones dying all around him left and right. He had really in some ways lost his mind. For a period of time, he would sit out in the jungle where there were dangerous tigers and such, and he sat in front of an open grave contemplating death himself, and he wouldn't talk to anybody, and he quit reading all of his Christian books, and he just sat there for a long, long time trying to collect himself. In a way, he had lost his mind. Life had just been way too hard. He had had too many losses. And it threw him into confusion. And mark it down. Once you go into confusion, then everything bad is possible. Anxiety, fear, depression, sadness. That's what was happening to him. Well, when he was a younger man, he had a great desire to have an evangelistic outreach to Jewish people. And he had some considerable clout as he got older and legendary, really, in the Christian world. And so he raised $1,000 for a missionary enterprise in Jerusalem. He really wanted this to be, you know, a for real missionary enterprise, and he just couldn't interest anybody in doing it. So after all of his fundraising efforts, there was no missionary enterprise in Jerusalem. He's very sorry for it. I'm sure it must have caused some confusion, like, Lord, wasn't this a good idea? And some sadness. Well, I raised $1,000 and it really didn't go anywhere. Which in those days, $1,000, you know, we are talking about the Civil War era. So earlier than the Civil War. So that's quite a lot of money. Well, 2 weeks before he died, he began to see the rest of the story. His wife, Emily, was reading to him a letter about a man who visited Turkey. And in Turkey, he ran into some Jewish people who had been reading about Adoniram Judson's life in a leaflet. And they were so interested in this man and his sacrifice and what he endured that they pursued it and they became Christians. And this guy is writing to Adoniram Judson to let him know that he ran into these Christians who were Jewish people so impressed with his life. And this, you know, in the next door country to the Holy Land. Beyond that, those Christians began talking to their friends, and the one man who became a Christian, a Jewish man, translated the leaflet so that his friends could read it as well. And they said, is there anybody that we can send from Constantinople, big city in Turkey, to our part of Turkey so that we can all respond to the gospel? And so Jewish evangelism was happening as a result of Adoniram Judson's life. It's the greatest story. So he's 2 weeks away from dying. And Emily said when she read him this letter, his eyes were filled with tears when I had done reading, she says. But still he at first spoke playfully, like, you know, you're a little embarrassed perhaps to cry and, you know, whatever. At first he spoke playfully and in a way that a little disappointed me. Then a look of almost unearthly solemnity came over him, and clinging fastly to my hand, he said, love, this frightens me. I don't know what to make of it. What? Why, what you have just been reading. I never was deeply interested in any object. I never prayed sincerely or earnestly for anything, but it came. At some time, no matter at how distant a day, somehow, in some shape, probably the last I should have desired, it came. And yet I have so little faith. May God forgive me. This is the guy who almost lost his mind because his life was so hard. He gets to the end of his life with new perspective. He says, it was all happening. I just didn't know it was happening. You know the rest of Adoniram Judson's story now. What I'm trying to communicate is that's happening to you. For all of us who believe, the rest of the story is glorious. You may not know on this side of heaven what your life meant, what it was all about, but it was definitely glorious. It was definitely radiant. And if you could just see it, then you wouldn't feel so anxious and depressed about the crisis that you're in right now. This is how it is. Confused, afraid, and sad, no more. This confusion that we have, and with it, the anxiety and sorrow that we have, this confusion is cured by the word of Christ together with time. So again, in Mark 8:27 through 10:52, this little, not even three chapters in the Gospel of Mark are very special because you have Jesus three times teaching his disciples that he is going to die and rise again. And every single time, all three times, the disciples don't understand what he's talking about, which is so amusing for us, you know, in hindsight. But for them, it was traumatic. And so we understand. But so here is the Apostle John and his fellow disciples listening to this in Mark 8. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he spoke that saying openly, and Peter took him and began to rebuke him. Like, nah, that's not true. I'm confused and you can't talk like this anymore because it upsets me. So that's Mark 8. Mark 9. As they came down from the mountain of transfiguration, he charged them that they should tell no man what things they had seen till the Son of Man were risen from the dead. And they kept that saying with themselves, questioning one with another what the rising from the dead should mean, which is also amusing to us in hindsight. I wonder what he meant by rising from death. I don't know. I have no idea. What could that possibly mean? How about it means he rose from death. But once again, they don't understand. They don't get it. That's Mark 8, Mark 9. And here we are, end of chapter 9. He taught his disciples, which is where we are today, by the way. He taught his disciples and said unto them, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men. They shall kill him. And after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day. But they understood not that saying, and they were afraid to ask him. Three times. Mark 8, Mark 9 early, Mark 9 later. And they just don't see it. They don't see it. The confusion could be cured by the word of Christ. But of course, you do have to be open to it, right? If the disciples had taken Jesus' words in their normal, natural meaning, everything would have been okay. But instead, they're thinking, I wonder what he meant by dying and raising from death. I wonder what he meant by that. For the most part, when Jesus says a thing is so, it just is so. He's not looking for you to be terribly creative or innovative about how you're going to rearrange his words to fit your preconceived notions. He just wants you to believe it as it is. And that would save the disciples so much grief. But at this moment, at least they have the words of Christ, which will begin to cure their confusion, anxiety, and depression. it says they were afraid to ask. Perhaps John and his fellow disciples were afraid to ask because their first impression of what it means for somebody to die and be raised from death is the correct one. Like, I'm not even going to ask. You know, we do that. Isn't that interesting that the Bible speaks this way? They were afraid to ask, and that's just become a thing in the English language. My son would come up to me and say, do you know what happened to me on the way home from work today? I say, I'm afraid to ask. I kind of have an idea this isn't going to be great. That's why the disciples were afraid to ask. Let's not go into this because you know what? I just can't handle this right now or really ever. So let's never talk about it. And they couldn't bear to think of the normal, natural, literal interpretation of Jesus' words. But at least they have that. And eventually, when Jesus is resurrected, everything is okay. This is the cure for their confusion, their anxiety, and their depression. And you know, that's ever the way. What they could not see when Jesus first talked to them about it, the betrayal, the crucifixion, the resurrection, all of this confused and frightened them and made them exceedingly sorrowful. What they couldn't see, they saw perfectly well at the end, you know, the rest of the story. Luke 24:50, Jesus is now going to leave them on earth to carry out the making of the church. And it says, Jesus led them out as far as Bethany. He lifted up his hands and blessed them. Now it came to pass while he blessed them that he was parted from them and carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him and they returned to Jerusalem with great joy. No more confusion, anxiety, depression. Now they understand what Jesus meant when he said, I'm going to die and I'm going to raise from death. They get it. Verse 53 says, and they were continually in the temple praising and blessing God. It wasn't like Jesus' words, his cure, his plan was only a little bit good. As if, well, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the Lord has an idea, and this is maybe 2 out of 3 times, or even 9 out of 10 times, the Lord's plan is pretty good. But you know what? I'm going to land on that 10th time, and it's not going to be great for me. But I know most of the time, in most cases, God's plan is good. It's not like that. It's like Jesus was raised from death. He blesses them. He looks them in the eye and says, you know, because I live, you also shall live. You're going to be okay. The biggest problem you ever had, death, is now solved. You chose to follow me. That choice is vindicated. You're all going to be okay. That's not just a little bit good, 2 out of 3 times good. That's overwhelmingly good. So Paul says, not worthy to be compared. Not worthy to be compared with the glory that should be revealed in us. It's all the way good, better than we could imagine. In 1945, Pastor Cliff Barrows wanted to marry his girlfriend. Trouble is, they don't have 2 nickels to rub together. So for a honeymoon, they could imagine that maybe they could get married, and for a honeymoon, he has a preaching engagement out of town. So he could go do his preaching, and they'll just make that their honeymoon, right? So that's what they did. That's all they could afford. So they go to the hotel, resort hotel, that they're supposed to be at for their time while he's preaching in that town. And the hotel was closed during the war. You know, the war is over in 1945, so they go there, and it's closed. Well, confusion, anxiety, sadness, that could happen. I mean, you don't have very much money anyway, and you go to the place you're supposed to go to, which isn't a very great hotel getaway anyway, because you're supposed to be preaching. And even that doesn't work out. That could throw a young couple into a bit of a tizzy, would it you? Well, they plan to stay there. It didn't work out. And they also don't have any transportation. So to the roadside they go with their thumbs out. The newlyweds are going to hitchhike to the next town. And maybe there they have a hotel they could stay at. So they get picked up as hitchhikers. And the guy says, well, you know, the place I'm taking you has a store. The store owner has these rooms over the store, and sometimes she lets people stay there for really cheap. You could try that. So to the store they go. They get their rooms over the top of the store. It turns out this lady is a Christian, and she feels very sorry for them. So after the first night, she says, well, I have a friend who might let you stay in his really nice house for free. They don't have to pay anything. It's not my idea of a honeymoon, but okay. So they go there and they stay for free. Well, the home of the shopkeeper's friend is also, you know, a Christian home. And they say, well, you're happy, we're glad to have you. But there, it turns out there's a youth rally in our town right now, and you should come to the youth rally. Well, okay. Not my idea of a honeymoon, but to the youth rally we go. And then the storekeeper's friend's youth rally is supposed to have singing and music, but the guy who's supposed to lead that is sick. So Cliff Barrows knows how to lead music and sing. He said, well, will you do this for our youth rally? Said, yes, I will. To the platform we go. So at the platform, he is leading the music, and the speaker that day at the youth rally is Billy Graham. Billy Graham loves what Cliff Barrows does with the music. He says, hey, you and I, we should be a team. So to the Billy Graham organization he goes. Together, they served for life, really. You know, 1945 wasn't yesterday. And they served as long as they lived, basically, together. Cliff Barrows became the host of Billy Graham's radio show during a lot of the evangelistic events. Cliff Barrows was the guy who led the choir, who led the music or sang whatever. And he was the man. And all of that because of what took place in Cliff Barrows' story. You know what you have to do then? You have to disappoint the guy in the first place because he doesn't have enough money for a proper honeymoon. And then you have to disappoint him in the second place because when he gets to the resort hotel, it's closed. And you have to disappoint him in the third place because they have to hitchhike down the road. Who wants to do that on their honeymoon? But then you know the rest of the story. So the confusion causes anxiety and depression. If you could lift the confusion, the entire trip would have been magical. But since you're confused, it doesn't seem magical in the moment. And that's the same thing that's happening with you. It's the same thing that's happening with us all. We're confused, and because we're confused, we're afraid, and we're sad. That confusion, however, is lifted by the Word of Christ, which you hold in your hand as the Holy Bible. And over time, as you follow Jesus, you're going to see that's the rest of your story. The rest of the story is the most important thing for a Christian to see.